Set your mind not on the things of the flesh, but the things of the Spirit. Please be seated. When Lyndon Johnson's grandparents moved to the hill country of Texas, they thought that they had stumbled into an agricultural treasure. In Robert Caro's epic biography of President Johnson, he writes of how they built a homestead and planted crops right out of the gate, crops that yielded abundant harvests. But those crops quickly diminished to the point that they realized quickly that something was wrong. It turns out that that rich topsoil that they had discovered and found it to be so fertile and fruitful was not a permanent feature of the hill country landscape, but rather it was a temporary product of several years of winds that had swept across the plains, depositing a beautiful but illusory top layer of soil. It was just enough for a few years of great harvest, but not much more. The perfect farmland that they had discovered turned out to be fleeting. That soil only had a few good years in it. Good soil simply cannot be taken for granted. In the parable of the sower, Jesus uses the metaphor of soil as the conditions in which faith takes root and bears an abundant harvest. Now, when soil is tired or rocky or inert, when the soil looks fantastic on the surface, but it lacks depth and biodiversity, our hearts cannot grow. And sometimes the soil is thin, which is when we try to take Jesus' words and situate them comfortably into the worldview that we have already decided on. When we try to fit Jesus into our national identity, for example, or vice versa, we plant seeds of faith in soil that lacks depth and will not yield the transformative relationship with God that we hope for. The same is true when we try to fit Jesus into our individualistic mindsets, which is the way of the modern secular world where we live less as disciples of Jesus than as consumers of religious or spiritual experience. That soil will not yield what we think it will either. Of particular concern are those thorns, those things in our lives that seem to grow wherever our favorite flowers do. And of course, this point in the summer, thorns and thistles are what we're growing in our yard these days. They grow there, and then they grab all the sunlight, and they cause our favorite plantings, the plantings of faith, to be wilty and sad. Paul seems concerned about this too, when he calls us to set our minds not on the things of the flesh, but upon the things of the Spirit. Paul's use of the word flesh can summon an image, but I want to use the parable of the sower to clarify what that might mean. It is tempting to hear Paul say this, choose between the things of the flesh and the things of the Spirit. It is tempting to hear that and then follow that down a very dualistic path. But Paul is not so much saying that the body is bad, so much as echoing the gospel idea of the thorns, where those things of the world crowd our souls and keep us from bearing fruit. The thorns are the flesh, which really means all the things in this world that keep us anxious, or seduced or fearful or apathetic or distracted. The things of the flesh are made up of a broad category of anything that occupies our minds and crowds out our capacity to grow in God. The things of the flesh are wealth and avarice. They are addiction in all its forms, from drugs to sex to social media. It is hedonism, which is the worship of worldly pleasures, that I think has become the baseline argument, the baseline pitch of all advertising. It is fear in all its forms, from fear of our mortality to fear of our neighbors. These are the things of the flesh. Now, there is a common denominator to all of those things, which paradoxically, for being the things of the flesh, keep us disembodied. Each one of those fleshy things turns us away from God, turns us away from our neighbors, and even takes us out of touch with our own bodies, often situating us in an interior world of ego and alienation and sometimes even shame. These fleshy things tend to give us a rush in the moment. We tend to think that they make us happy, but not the equanimity kind of happy, though, but the dopamine rush of pleasure or pain that we have come to believe is the only way to be alive. But that's not the only way to be alive, and it is certainly not the only way to be happy. The Greeks had several words for happiness. One is the term that our Western culture ran with, while the other, the one that produces what we would call good soil, kind of fell by the wayside, at least in terms of what we talk about, how we talk about what we value. The one we chose without naming it was hedonia, which is the pursuit of pleasure and enjoyment and the avoidance of pain. It turns out, and the Greeks didn't know this, that this is attractive for biological, neurological reasons. This is attractive because pleasure produces that wonderful neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is the brain's reward system, and most, if not all, of the things of the flesh come with some kind of dopamine kick. From the pleasure of that glass of wine to the endorphin rush that comes from yelling at the latest news in your Instagram feed. So there is some biological stuff going on here. The things of the flesh are often aligned with a neurological reward system. We have evolved to desire that piece of chocolate cake. Why? Because it's made almost entirely out of chocolate. And chocolate produces happy feelings. I'm not railing against chocolate, by the way. That's fine. The problem is that too much of this only leads to the need for more. It is fleeting, and it leaves an emptiness in its wake. It's hill country soil that blows away after too many plantings. And it leads us to a disembodied life, stuck up in our heads, which is ironic, considering that these are the things of the flesh. The other path to happiness, according to the ancients, is eudaimonia, which is closer to what we'd call fulfillment. It's the happiness not of quick pleasure, but of being fully alive, engaged, purposeful, growing, contributing. Now, I got that from a site called Soul Mind Hub, but I would go far deeper than that and say that eudaimonia is what we feel when our lives are integrated, when we have learned to trust and abide in God, when we are deeply aware of our belovedness. Eudaimonia lights up different parts of the brain, avoiding dopamine and instead producing a sustained baseline shift that does not require maintenance or escalation. In short, it is the cultivation of soil that is fruitful and rich, capable of bearing a harvest season in and season out of 60 and 100-fold. Set your mind not on the things of the flesh, but the things of the Spirit. Now, we can be forgiven for thinking that Paul was giving us a binary vision of the spiritual life. It certainly sounds like that, right? Flesh is bad, spirit is good. And to be sure, a lot of the fleshy places where we get into trouble have something to do with the body. But a dualistic mindset, if we're going to take that path, a dualistic mindset is its own set of thorns and can therefore be just as fleshy as that slice of cake. That is not the good soil that Jesus is talking about, nor is it the spirit mindset that Paul is pushing us towards. The thorns and the thistles of this life are real, and the cares of the world, from those very real fears that we lived with to our temptations to comfort and wealth and security, those are a part of our lives day in and day out. But the path of spirit and grace is every bit as real as those thistles and thorns. Jesus calls us to something far more whole than anything a dualistic mindset will give us, and far more rewarding than the things that give us a rush in the moment. And it starts simply, not with dump trucks of fresh topsoil, or even the harsh removal of weeds, so much as a simple reframing. To set your mind on things of the Spirit, things like gentleness, generosity, discipleship, and humility. To set your mind on those things is to begin the journey back to God and to put down roots in soil that is rich and fertile. This is the soil that will yield fruit far beyond our wildest imaginations. Amen.